for today, huh, Chair?
A big one.
Yeah.
That's what they did.
Maybe.
4 o'clock.
That's right.
Maybe.
That's what it is.
No, that's a good one.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. It's Wednesday, April 15th. Sorry, I'm running a little bit late. Up first, we have a public hearing on House Bill 2438, and so I will open that public hearing on House Bill 2438. Victoria, would you give us a brief summary of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2438 prohibits health insurers from requiring providers to collect deductibles or amounts chargeable to co-insurance from patients as a condition for receipt of payment from insurer. Applies to policies issued on or after effective date.
Thank you. And before us, we have Representative Maurer, and welcome to our committee. And good afternoon, and maybe you can explain to us what she just read.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee, Representative Ron Maurer, serving House District 3, which is most of Yosemite County. As you know, or most of you may know, I owned a small rural health clinic, a small primary care clinic in Rogue River, Oregon, and I was a business guy. My wife's a nurse practitioner. We have since sold that clinic effective March 1st of this year. So I'm not in that business anymore. But over the course of 7 years, it became very evident to me that there are some issues in operating outpatient clinics. And one of those issues is in the realm or in the world of billing and how that works. Most of the time when you go to, and I'm going to explain how this billing works, because without some background, this bill doesn't make any sense. When you go to the doctor's office, you normally walk up to the window, and if you have a copay, you pay your $20-$30 copay, if you have a copay in your policy, and this is assuming you have insurance. You see the doctor, and you wave as you're going out the door, and you kind of wait for, you know, a month later, 2 months later, maybe to get a statement from the insurance company and maybe a bill from the doctor's office, and that doesn't seem to be a terribly efficient system. And what happens behind closed doors is after you've had your visit, your doctor codes that visit using one of 7,800 procedural codes, known as CPT codes or common procedural terminology, along with an ICD-9, which is an international common, I don't know what it is, but it's a diagnosis code of saying, you know, what type of diabetes, a sign, a symptom of what you've got. So you have these two codes, and you know, the doctor's office are pretty good at it. They, you know, it's their business. They get pretty good at it. And they submit it on a claim form to the insurance company. And in fact, the doctor's offices submit these claim forms on a standardized form, a CMS 1500, and I won't necessarily pass it around, but it's a standardized form. And most doctor's offices, quite frankly, do this electronically. It's not done on paper. There are still insurances that do it on paper, but that's, you know, that's past history. As we move forward, more of this is done electronically. But the doctor's office, when they send that claim to the insurance company, sits around and waits for a check.
No, this is the bill.
And then the doctor's office doesn't necessarily know what they're going to get paid. I mean, they could calculate it based on their contract, which is negotiated usually by someone else, not by themselves. And so they get an eventually they get an explanation of benefits. And what I had passed out is a sample EOB that I pulled off the internet. Thanks, Representative Gilliam, for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
This explanation of benefits is sent.
I apologize for him.
That's not possible, Mr. Chair.
Where am I glad
is sent back to the doctor's office, and the EOB, along to the provider, is usually a check attached. And on the EOB, it says the date of service and the service code, which is your CPT, how much the doctor charged for the visit, how much the contract allowed or the negotiated amount, a copay if there was one, deductibles, and coinsurance. Well, now, this is a month later, usually, you know, I'll just say 30 days later, given some transaction time.
All right, go ahead.
The doctor now knows, well, I charge that, let's say, for example, $110, and I know that the insurance company paid me $63. Now I have to go out, and I've got to chase $27, just hypothetically. In this example, actually, there was a copay of $20, which they got. But now they got to go chase $7 called coinsurance. Well, whose responsibility is that? Is it the insurance company? No. Is it the employer? No. It's the doctor's office. So now the doctor's office is not a doctor's office. They're a bill collector. Now they have to go through a billing cycle. And most billing cycles are monthly. Maybe if you're sophisticated, you have a biweekly billing cycle. But usually it's monthly. So now they're waiting another 30 days. They don't have to, but they send a bill out to the client or the patient. The patient writes the check, hopefully, or writes a credit card number down, hopefully, and mails it back to the provider. Now, for the insurance company, and this is obviously controversial, this is pretty significant change, folks, and I'm not suggesting that this should be taken lightly. But the provider is now a bill collector. You know, when people operate a business, they try to stick to a core business model. Well, doctors should be doctors. They shouldn't necessarily be bill collectors. And that's what they are. In my office alone, I spent about 20% of my overhead was on bill collecting. That is a substantial waste in the system. And frankly, we weren't very good at it. That is not our core business.
That's what we are.
I got better at it, and I had some staff that were pretty good at it. But that's not what we do. So what this bill does is dictate to the insurance companies, and I hate doing this, but dictate to the insurance companies, and when you contract with a medical provider, the only thing that medical provider is required to collect would be the at-time service copay, not a deductible, and not the coinsurance. But that would be the responsibility of the insurance company, thus getting the provider out of the business of being a bill collector. Now again, this is serious business. This is a lot of money, and the insurance company is probably shaking their head that this is a bad thing. But this is part of the conversation. Excuse me, sir?
They'll get off the floor in a minute.
Okay.
Fast out.
Peel them off the ceiling. But this is part of the conversation that we need to be having about changing how we finance health care and how we pay for health care. And so, you know, there are a lot of reasons that this may not work, and I'm sure we'll hear a lot of those reasons. But there's probably some reasons that it makes sense for providers not to be in this business. Now, are the providers, should they be held harmless in this? I would suggest absolutely not. The provider needs to pay for the privilege of not being a bill collector. And in fact, all of the doctors that I've talked to have said, you know, we would take less reimbursement from the insurance company if this was not something that we had to do. And that the insurance companies, quite frankly, they have contact with the patient through the EOB. And usually on an EOB, explanation of benefit, it says, this is not an invoice or this is not a bill.
Yeah.
Well, write that out and say, this is a bill. And therefore, we are transferring responsibility in a pretty substantial way to a different entity. But sometimes these entities, like insurance companies, are really sophisticated and are actually quite efficient at doing some of these administrative details. That's the purpose of the bill. That's the purpose of the conversation, and I will finish with that.
Thank you for that, and I loved your first statement that without any background, this bill made absolutely no sense. So I appreciate the background. Questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Maurer, so if I were an insurance company, how would this benefit me? Why would I agree to this?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I apologize. I do. I apologize.
It's been done before.
It's been done before. I apologize.
I wasn't going
to
say that.
You were not. This is not something that you necessarily want to do. Historically, you, and I want to say you and us, and but as an insurance company, you don't want to take that responsibility because that is now a liability that you are taking on, and in fact, you are going to have bad debt. And currently, the bad debt is held by the providers. And what do the providers do? They write it off. That is bad debt. Services provided, they did not get reimbursement for. In some ways, that bad debt ultimately gets distributed, you know, back to the consumer somehow. I wouldn't necessarily call this a cost shift, but I suppose, you know, at some level it could be. So it is transferring a responsibility, and they would not want to accept that responsibility.
Follow up. Okay, this will be, I hope, my last question. Mm-hmm. So you say that the providers would, in order to get out of this responsibility, would be willing to take less money from the insurance company. So the patient responsibility on this explanation of benefits that you gave us is $27, which now the provider is going to try to bill the patient for, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tobin, in fact, yes. In the example that I gave you, what I believe, though, there's a $20 copay, which was due at the time.
Oh, I see. So
at
now
the time of service. Actually, the provider's going to only chase
$7.
No, $7.
Okay.
Yes.
Why wouldn't you, as the provider, just forgive the $7 rather than taking up staff time? And you say 20% of your overhead is bill collecting, so why not, if that's true, why not just forgive that $7?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, in fact, in this example, that is a relatively low coinsurance. In a provider's office, and this is, I'm purely shooting from the hip, but I would probably believe that most of our co-insurances are in the $20 to $25 range that we are going to go out to the patient, and that excluding deductibles, which, you know, in January and February, generally you do most of your deductibles, that in our own office, that we had something in the neighborhood of 2,500 patient visits a year. 2,500 times 20 adds up, and it's a pretty substantial piece of lost revenue, or if we just said write it off. In fact, there are times we do write it off. For Medicare II in our office, we decided not to bill for lab draws for Medicare patients because it was a $12 draw that I had to bill separately and got $3 in reimbursement, and it probably cost me $10 to do the dang claim form. So in that case, it didn't make any sense. But, you know, ultimately, you can't do that. You know, at some point, it's real money. We're not talking a big business. We're talking one provider office.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Maurer, for bringing this forward. Customarily, by the way, we'd like to have enough copies. If you can make more copies, I almost had to share with Representative Tomei. See? And my question is this. You mentioned that a provider would be willing, you think, to pay for not having to be the bill collector. How do you envision that happening? Because we're not mandating it here, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, in fact, that the bill would prohibit a contract that would require a provider to collect coinsurance and a deductible. And so essentially when the contract was renegotiated, that the new rate that the contract or that the provider and the insurance company agreed to obviously would have to take this into account. And I know that this would, you know, if it was enforced today, that there would be much gnashing of teeth across the state of Oregon between providers and insurance companies and provider organizations trying to figure out how they are going to do this. So You know, this is again, should not be taken lightly. But yes, this would be a mandate.
Follow up.
But you're not mandating that the doctor's office pay a portion.
No.
Okay.
So I'll go down to Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure I understand this. And you, from this bill's proposal, is that the provider would only be obliged to collect the copay, not the deductible or the coinsurance. So if I'm looking at, and I'm just trying to keep this simple, so I'm just looking to look at the top line on your example billing here of a $110 charge for which the negotiated amount is $90. Let's forget what those negotiations would be in the future. But if this were in place today with those numbers, the provider would then collect the $20, so they would still be owed $70 for their doing business. So then if I'm understanding you correctly, the insurance company would be expected to send the provider $70 and then go back and collect from their insured that extra $7, which is the coinsurance. Or a second example, and then you can answer it. If I say, go to my provider and I have a $150 bill, but I have a $100 deductible on my insurance, and this is in January, the insurance company would then be expected to pay my provider $150, even though their obligation was only $50 because I hadn't met my deductible. And so then the insurance company would be expected to collect $100 from me. Are those both examples,
Chair,
both what you're getting at here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, you should become a medical biller. You are spot on. That is exactly correct.
I may be, and I now have a giant target for from the insurance companies on my forehead. I can see that.
Yes.
Thank you, sir.
There are a number of patients that that just walk out the door and you never see them again.
I understand.
And that's
okay,
called
thanks.
Bad debt.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Maurer, just let's assume for the sake of argument that all of the money that exchanged hands here is based on people's costs of doing business, and so that's not going to change. What we're really going to do with your bill is just shift the pricing around, it seems to me. So help me, I guess my question to you is, just help me understand how this is going to change the patient's relationship to the cost of these services. Are they likely to walk in now and have a medical bill that maybe is slightly less from the doctors? In other words, the doctor's reimbursement from the insurance company might be slightly less, but now they're going to have a relationship where they will not have deductibles offered to them, probably from insurance companies, because insurance companies, that's no longer a business model that's going to work for them, and so they're going to have some kind of a billing arrangement where they have direct power. How do you expect insurance companies will react to this as far as their business model goes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, that is an excellent question, and I thought about it, and I suspect deductibles would disappear, copays would increase, that in fact you would still, the coinsurance would be the way that they would bill the patient. I also, how is this going to help the overall system in reducing dollar? I think what it gets back to is when the patient or when not the patient, the individual or the family fails to make a premium payment to the insurance company or the company they work for fails to make a payment. In fact, I would prefer to see that the employer not be involved in this, that we break that relationship between the employer and your health insurance. Have no problem with the employer contributing substantial. Whatever they want to contribute, I think, is great. But the relationship really needs to be between the doctor, the patient, and the insurance company. And that the patient-doctor relationship needs to be held intact and not necessarily a strict financial relationship. The financial relationship needs to really be between the insurance company and the patient if we are going to have an insurance model in this country. And so it is. If I don't pay my co-insurance, if I don't pay, you know, keep my debt low, or you know, on a payment plan, the insurance company is going to have reason, they're going to have cause to drop me. Today, if I don't get paid as a provider, the insurance company frankly says, okay, whatever. They have no say in that conversation, and to them it's not a loss. But to the individual providers who are eating it, in fact, that is a loss. And so they do have to raise their rates. In a business model, you have to accommodate bad debt someplace in that model.
So before I go on to Representative Riley, I just want to clarify something for myself. And so if I hear you correctly, you're saying that the coinsurance and deductible amounts are, from your perspective, are a contractual arrangement between the insurance, the insurer, and the insured, and the insurer shouldn't be making you collect that money. You should be getting reimbursed as the provider your reimbursed amount, and not enter into a system where you're trying to collect the coinsurance or deductible amounts from the patient, that because that's an arrangement that the patient has with their insurance company.
Essentially, that is correct. Now, there's, quite frankly, there's nothing holding the providers or a gun to the provider's head to say that they have to enter into these contracts today. But that is the standard way of doing business. There could be an arrangement, I believe, today where we could do, without a bill, that there could be contracts arranged that way. But that's not how it's done. And the individual providers, I'm not quite sure how we got into this cycle that we're in, but we're here. And I think it's terribly inefficient. It doesn't do the individual, you know, the providers any good. The insurance companies are, that's the way they are used to doing business. And so this clearly would upset the apple cart.
Thank you, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, and I'll ask them both at once, and then you can pick and choose which one you want to answer first. But the two questions are, one, how many insurance companies does a typical provider deal with? And secondly, you talked about the 30-day delay, and isn't it quite often you have another cycle because you have another insurance company, a secondary, and so you have to go through two of those, get checks from two insurance companies, and then finally pick up the end? Those are the two questions.
I can't speak for other clinics, but we had a list of probably, well, close to 300 different insurance addresses, not necessarily different companies, but Regents, Oregon, Blue Cross Idaho, Blue Cross Illinois, Blue Cross California. But on a routine basis, we dealt with less than 20. And the vast majority of those, quite frankly, were Regents, Pacific Source, LifeWise, Medicare, Medicaid. And so you're dealing routinely, your vast majority, with very few insurances.
20.
Yeah. I'm sorry, the other question?
The other question was the coinsurance,
Yes. In fact, most private insurance, commercial, you know, you don't bill twice. Most families aren't dual insured. There's usually one member who's insured. Where you get into the secondary is in Medicare. And to Medicare's credit, they call it a crossover. I bill Medicare, they cross over electronically to the secondary, the patient's secondary, and that's a seamless, in most cases, is seamless, and that system is improving substantially. So in that case, Medicare is efficient. There's no auditing in that system, but from a payment standpoint, that's efficient.
Thank you. Other questions? Not seeing any. I appreciate you bringing us a simple short bill, and we'll take it into consideration.
Yes, sir. And Chair, I do appreciate the time and the conversation outside of healthcare committee, because we get very, you know, you deal with the same issues and the same people. And so
I don't know how this one slipped over here. maybe as they didn't have time for it, I don't know. It had the word insurance in it, so it could have been anything.
Thank you.
Appreciate your bringing this bill forward. And
not as much as I do, Mr. Chair.
Up next, we have John Powell. And do I see you marked neutral on this bill?
Nope. Members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. And Mr. Chairman, apparently the Speaker's office forgot that note that said the bill was sent here to die. Representative Maurer,
he knows better than that.
Was kind enough to invite me into his office early in the session and inform me about this bill. And I had a hard time understanding it then, and then it came out in print, and I had even a more difficult time understanding it. It does have some deficiencies in the way it is written, because our contract does not require the provider to collect coinsurance and deductibles. They do as a matter of course, but our contract does not require them, and that's the trigger in the bill. But that's just simply a deficiency in drafting. Mr. Chair and members, what this bill does is it shifts a cost. And where is it going to end up? Is it more efficient to shift it from a local community provider to people in their community, to shift that to Portland or to Kansas City, wherever the payer might be? That's a big question. But ultimately, the cost, the overage cost in this case, and I think it would cost more than the savings, because it would be less efficient. I think you would be more apt to pay your local provider that you want to be able to go back to than you would a third party who really, as the way the bill is written, would have no leverage over collecting that. We couldn't cancel them for that, for example, as long as they paid their premium. So there's no provision in there for us to get tough. Plus, if it's a group policy, the employer paying the premium wouldn't want half of their people canceled because they didn't send their deductible check to their insurance company. So we see that there's no model for this in the United States. That, to our knowledge, this is not done anywhere. And it would change. And I think ultimately what it would mean would mean that the employer would end up and the individual policyholder, if it's purchased by an individual, would end up paying this cost in higher premiums through what is known as first dollar coverage. And as Representative Maurer said, that's in answering Representative Cowan's question he would expect to receive basically what the contracted amount would be in total, which would be first dollar coverage. And the insurer, in the case of Regents, nearly a million claims a month, would then most likely, as opposed to turning into a collection system, simply sell first dollar coverage type policies. And I think most of the industry would do that, and I think that's why this model probably doesn't exist anywhere. Cost sharing is controversial. It does make the policy more affordable for employers, and we do not in any way deny that collections are a problem in any business, including medical. But another problem with this is that the insurer is not part of the transaction between the patient and the doctor. I had one experience where I made them, the doctor's office, take a test off my bill because I didn't get it. They didn't perform that test, and I think they, in their office, they legitimately thought they did. I don't think they were trying to get paid for something they didn't do, but I called twice, in fact, and they finally agreed to take it off. It wasn't that much money. It was just the thought of it to me. So anyway, not being a party to that transaction, if somebody's dissatisfied with the service they got and they're not going to pay as a consequence of that, that would put us in the middle of a transaction that we're not part of. So I've heard more problems with this bill than I could ever keep in my mind at this time in the session. So that's all I can remember right now.
I appreciate your candidness.
I don't know if he's made his case, though.
Yeah, I'm just going to...
Maybe I can come up with a couple more.
So just, you know, thinking about it in simple terms, which is probably not the insurance way, but it seems like the first dollar coverage, you know, would eliminate a tremendous amount of overhead and collection costs, and you know, it seems like if everybody did that, insurance premiums would be cheaper across the country. This system get worked out? Because it seems like, as Representative Maurer said, that this is an insurance plan between an insurance company and a patient, and the doctor is getting stuck with being a collection agency on behalf of the insurance company to make themselves whole for the reimbursement that they deserve.
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question. There is a principle in insurance, and it's discussed in all the reforms that we've done over the years in terms of utilization of services when one has nothing at stake in utilizing them. And deductibles and coinsurance have been part of insurance mechanisms in almost all lines of insurance except death. I don't know that there's a deductible on a life insurance policy, but in most lines of insurance, deductibles and coinsurance are there as a bar to overutilization. And to take those away would spike utilization. I don't think there's any doubt. I'm not an expert in that area, but I know there are studies that show that fairly plainly.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Honorable Chair Holby. John, I actually kind of like the concept that Ron's brought before us here, and I'm just wondering if there would be a way, because like here we're looking at a difference of $7. So it's $20 copay. If the copay was $27, because I'm sure there has to be numbers there for when someone's getting an MRI, this, and this, that you could do a percentage. I guess there are some programs that do percentage, but people know, okay, I'm going into the doctor because I got a possible ear infection. I know he's going to look at me and I'm going to get a prescription off of this. It's going to cost me $15, my copay. Is there some sort of formula you can put together like that to where now you're not having to bill out at other places and send back to get $7 because insurance didn't cover it and cut the paperwork down? Because when you're talking, they're $20 amounts, but when you're looking at 2,500 of these a year, now you're talking serious dough. And a way to get rid of that, because with 20% of your overhead, I mean, that's probably two full-time employees they're looking at just on chasing bad debt. Because one of the things that I think about lots of times is when I used to go into the doctor, there was one lady who worked up front, and there was a doctor and a nurse in the back. Now there's five people up front just dealing with insurance and paperwork, and still the same doctor and nurse in the back. So something needs to change there in this process, and I'm not sure if you guys discussed that and could help us with solving this problem.
Mr. Chair and Representative Widener, the model would tend to go back to first dollar coverage. You just can't get away from that. Trying to develop a system where that basically in one transaction pays for everything, you simply end up back at first dollar coverage. And you know, Representative Maurer's clinic may have 2,500 of those transactions a month. At an insurer like Regions, it would be a million. And so when you start keeping track of a person that was billed $7 and they sent you three, and that keeping track of systems like that, we would be hiring those people. Passage of this bill would not take all those people away. They still have Medicare billings. They deal with Medicaid patients. They would still have to bill the insurance company. So you'd still see people out there in front that wouldn't get rid of all of that billing. They're still going to have to do billings. They're just not going to have, they would not have to follow up with that particular patient based on their copay and deductible. So that would be the piece you'd be fixing. You wouldn't be fixing the entire, you wouldn't be getting them out of paper. It'd still be in the paperwork business.
We're down to two instead of five.
Representative Wingard.
John, I want to stay on this issue. I see your point that the collectors don't go away. And I take your point that the reason to have these additional co-insurance elements is to try to get people to think about overutilization. I get that. But I don't think you've made a convincing argument as to why the provider should be the person who collects that. I mean, you can continue to have your co-insurance and the additional amount that you expect the insured person to pay. And as you said, the reason for it is to limit overutilization, which is not in the provider's interest. It's in your interest to limit overutilization. So it seems to me then that even makes the argument more strongly for the insurance companies to be in the business of collecting this money.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wingard, the interest is not necessarily with the insurer. It's with the pool of people paying the premiums. That's who has an interest in utilization. The insurer can, as I said, we can bill any way, any system, first dollar. It would be more expensive. I think a rudimentary principle of business in this country is those who provide a service do bill or make arrangements to be paid. Insurance provides a fairly good collection mechanism for medical providers overall. In another committee yesterday, we were talking about a prompt pay bill, and the provider said, you know, if we don't get that money on a certain date, we're in trouble. And they rely on insurance. And so it does provide, I think, a very beneficial floor of income. There is the amount that the local provider is responsible for. And again, if you look, I think, at the efficiency of collection, who is most apt to get that payment? A local provider that in most cases people will want access to. I would pay the guy with the needle before I'd pay the guy with a gas pump if I had to choose. If I have to go back to the dentist, I want that guy happy or that woman happy. And I want him to let me in the door.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you talk about first day pay or whatever, first dollar pay, and the fact that that doesn't give any incentive for stopping overutilization, what some people call preventive medicine, so I wonder what you think about what I just said.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, I don't. The issue of preventative medicine, I think, is different than overutilization. Overutilization would be a child gets a cold. In the first day of that cold or the second day, do you rush to the doctor's office and have the doctor say, child has a cold? Preventative medicine, on the other hand, would be a checkup or a test on a regular basis at a certain age, inoculations, at certain ages and those sorts of things, which I think are different. In fact, many health plans pay first dollar on those types of plans. I think the women's annual medical checkup is mandated by law to pay. So on the preventative side, first dollar coverage many times is part of the plan.
Okay.
In order to encourage utilization for this.
Thank you.
You've exhausted our questioning, it looks like.
And the witness.
The intriguing issue. Thank you very much for your testimony today. I appreciate you coming before this committee again. And did we have anyone else signed up? Mr. Higginson, are you signed up for this bill? Oh, okay. It must be a different one. You don't care to comment on it either, I bet. So no other business on this bill at this time. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2438. And I'm going to open a work session. Are we ready for a work session?
Yes.
Representative Matthews?
Sure.
Open a work session on House Bill 3020. Representative Matthews, welcome to the podium down there for House Consumer Protection. Good afternoon. And maybe you can review where we're at with this bill. We sent it out for a couple of important fixes to the bill, and I assume that we've got them back. I actually haven't had time to look at them. So maybe you can brief us on that. Amazed that we got them back so quickly.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Matthews, State Representative, House District 50, the great city of Gresham. What you have before you, again, is House Bill 3020, and there are -2 amendments now. If you recall, we had quite a bit of conversation that came through the -1 first came as a result of legislative council trying to see that there was no specific definition for deployed under state or federal law, so we came in with service member. The -2 expands on that in the direction that we needed to go, according to our Attorney General's office. This has been a collaborative effort. I want to mention, of course, my good representative partner on this, Freeman, who is also part of this, the AG's office, of course, our Department of Veterans Affairs, the Governor's office as well, with help from Paul Evans. Really, just to refresh your memory, when we first heard testimony on this, I think there's a little bit of our committee wondering, like, well, is this really necessary? Don't we have things in place now? And then we heard from Jim Willis, who had kind of reminded us on behalf of the veterans that there are some really egregious acts out there and some people taking advantage of our disabled veterans, our service members, our spouses while our service members are deployed. One case in point that he talked about was on wheelchairs, the rascal scooters, and people giving specific fitments, collecting money, and then never returning with the scooter itself, and deposits lost. And not only deposit, but emotional feeling that you've been taken advantage of by somebody like that because you're vulnerable. So what this will do, of course, as you know, is put this under unlawful trade, and it'll take these folks and it'll put it under UTPA for unconscionable tactics and add those folks especially protected. And I think it's necessary. It's unfortunate that it is. I would like to say that we can count on our fellow men and women to take care of each other. There are, unfortunately, it seems like we spend a great deal of time trying to address those folks that are taking advantage of others. And in this case, by placing them in this category, especially protected citizens, I think we're doing a great service to these folks and their families. And I'm proud to have the bill. I want to point out also, and again, this happened awfully quick, and I'm very impressed, but we got our fiscal and revenue impact statements back, and it has no fiscal and no revenue. So I was proud of that. And furthermore, no impact to local governments as well. So pretty rare that we get bills these days that they come back with that kind of clearing. But I'm excited that it does, and hopefully we can have a due pass out of the committee. And I'd be honored to carry the bill with Representative Freeman, if you so choose.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Mr. waiting for a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3020.
Representative Riley moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 3020. Any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to adopting those amendments? So adopt, dash two amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move House Bill 3020 to the floor as amended with due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 3020 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Matthews, I just wanted to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it's another good bill that we should move quickly on, and like you to carry it on the floor along with Representative Freeman, did you say?
Yes, Chair Holby, thank you.
Good carry it. Okay, so ordered. Can we have a roll call vote on the bill, please?
Representative Barton?
Excused.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3020, having received the required votes, declare passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And as noted, Representative Matthews and Freeman will co-carry the bill on the floor. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3020 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2959. Victoria, would you please review House Bill 2959 for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2959 prohibits hospital from using patient's credit or financial information in determining course of care recommended by physician. Imposes civil penalty for violations.
Thank you. For the record, I just want to note the committee, I believe the committee has gotten a handout from Oregonians for Health Security on House Bill 2959. They are not here to testify today, but up first we have Angela Martin.
Mr. Chair, I don't have that handout. Was that sent electronically and maybe didn't get in here? Or?
That's a good question.
Don't you mean systems, health systems?
No, there's a different one.
Oh, I don't have that one. So it, we'll work on getting the, maybe this just came to me.
Okay.
Actually, it didn't. It came to members of the committee, too. So it might be my fault for not getting this distributed to you.
Where did this come from?
That one I have. Yeah, that one we've got two of. It's the Oregonians for Health Security that... Yeah,
we'll get the other one to you as well.
Give it to him.
I'm not exactly sure when I received it.
Oh, you have it too?
Oh, okay. So, welcome to the committee. If you'd like to introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Angela Martin with Our Oregon. Appreciate the opportunity to support, testify in support of House Bill 2959, which, as you'll read, is a very short bill addressing a problem that I hope to review very shortly through my testimony. This bill would prohibit the use of credit scores or financial information to determine the course of medical care available to a patient. Credit assessments have been attached to consumers for quite some time. Used to be it was informally attached, information shared between business owners about who pays and who doesn't pay. That system was formalized over the years, over the last 45 years, really consolidated through technology into three main credit reporting bureaus. The most widely used and commonly understood is the Fair Isaac Corporation, or the FICA score. Everyone knows their FICA score, right? The system was actually developed just recently in 1989. The system and policies that guide the tracking of each of our financial achievements and misfortunes are constantly changing to meet the demands of industry and the needs for consumer protection. It's because of technological improvements that have sped up the access to information and the Fair Credit Reporting Act passed in 1971 that we have strong consumer protections and more people have access to credit. However, the flip side to this is that the use of credit scoring has increased, as have the potential for abuses of the use of credit scores have also increased. Today, a credit score often determines consumer access to not only credit, but housing, auto insurance, basic utility service, even employment. As a result, the rate that you pay for either being judged as a good driver or not a good driver depends on whether you knew how to use your credit card or didn't, weren't able to make your credit card payments on time. We see the impact thanks to the financial crisis happening right now and the credit crunch causing credit card companies to reduce your credit limit available. That has a negative impact on your credit score. So through no action and no fault of your own, today's consumers are seeing their credit score go down, and as a result, the decisions about, again, what kind of auto insurance is available to them is also adversely affected. We're here today with House Bill 2959 to make sure we do not add medical care to the list of decisions that are made thanks to what your standing is in credit. Fortunately, I'm not coming to you with stories about the negative impact this process or practice has had on Oregon patients. Instead, I'm asking that we take a proactive step. That is because this is a new product, a new tool that is still in development by three corporations that have fronted the $30 million necessary to develop this credit reporting tool. News reports and the testimony from Oregonians for Health Security, which you don't have in front of you, included a news report, indicate and explain that this score would be based on an individual's history of paying their medical bills. Similar to your FICA score, slow payments and defaults would result in negative reports and a lower medical credit score. It is, however, unclear how untimely payments would be registered when the payee is an insurance company, and therefore the timeliness of your payment is out of your hands as the patient. The backers of medical credit scoring product are quick to claim that the tool will have no impact on medical treatment and would only be used at the billing stage to help a hospital make decisions about whether a patient will be able to pay his or her bill, or if it would be in their financial interest to simply write it off as bad debt. House Bill 2959 simply ensures that this intent is enshrined in law, in Oregon law, by making it a policy of the state that licensed hospitals do not use persons' credit standing as a factor in their course of care. Already, a consumer's credit record and corresponding credit score determines access and pricing for the most fundamental financial and consumer services. We urge you to make sure that medical care is not, again, added to this list. In walking into the testimony today, I picked up a copy of the testimony from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and read their concern regarding the fact that this could potentially limit a person's options for selecting affordable care. Now, while I was not involved in the drafting of this bill, in speaking with other proponents, I can assure you that was not their intent and would also be certain that they'd be happy to work on any technical fixes necessary. The intent of this is to make sure, again, your credit score doesn't determine your course of medical care. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Matthews?
Thank you, Chair Holvey. And thank you for addressing that. Thanks for your testimony today, because one of my concerns when I read this bill, and having been on scene with a number of patients that simply refuse medical care because they can't afford it for whatever reason, I was just wondering if there was going to be an out for that. And it sounds like you're open to that in terms of amendments, and perhaps we'll hear from the other side that might be willing to go there as well. But that was my first concern, so I appreciate you addressing that in your testimony. Thank you.
Other questions? I'm not seeing any at this point. I also want to note for the record that we've received also testimony from Osberg, yeah. Written testimony. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that. This does seem to be another interesting healthcare issue in front of us. And next up we have Grant Higginson. Dr. Grant Higginson, excuse me.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I'm the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Department of Human Services, and one of the programs in my office is the Healthcare Licensing and Certification Program, which is responsible for ensuring that over 500 agencies and facilities in the state of Oregon are providing safe and healthy environments for the care, the health care that they are providing. So this is an issue that's of interest to me because of that. We are neutral on the policy implications of the bill because we just do not know of any data to suggest at the extent to which this is happening right now or whether or not it's leading to negative impacts. We do, however, have to oppose this bill because the requirements of setting up a complaint investigation system and citing civil penalties for people who would break this law is something that cannot be covered within our existing resources and funding for such a process is not included in the governor's recommended budget. So with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I guess I'd appreciate, Dr. Higginson, if you'd elaborate a little bit on we're not getting complaints of someone coming and saying, I had my credit history checked and I was refused medical care, are we?
Chair Holvey and Representative Cowan, not that we are aware of. They are not coming to us.
Thank you. For the record, I have actually been contacted by a provider who was complaining about this particular practice of patients being having their credit score checked to determine whether or not they would spend the night in the hospital, for example. And so, I'm just curious if you would comment on, you know, that approach to medicine where it's if in fact, hypothetically, if that is the case, that happens, is that, I guess if you can afford it, you can have the health care. If you cannot, you cannot have the health care. And that, is that essentially the way our system is set up?
Chair Holvey, I mean, to a great extent, that is the way the system's set up because it is a business rather than a, you know, entitlement or right. So, I guess it doesn't totally surprise me that those things are happening. And should a complaint like that come to us, not that I was refused to spend the night in the hospital because of my credit score, but instead came to us, you know, I was extremely sick and was not admitted to the hospital to spend the night, and I think that's inappropriate. That's a complaint that we would handle right now. But it would not be revolving around the financial payment. It would be revolving around whether that person got adequate care. And that's the kind of complaint that we follow up on now.
Thank you. Mr. Riley.
Thank you. So, in fact, you don't really know. You may have gotten complaints that were caused by this, but you don't know that that was the cause of the denial of care. Is that?
Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, that is possible, and it's something that we wouldn't necessarily check on the financial implications. What we check on is the care.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for showing up and testifying in front of our committee today. Not hearing any other discussion on this. Representative Tomei.
Mr. Chair, could we bring Ms. Martin back up?
Certainly. Ms. Martin, would you care to come back up?
I'm sort of slow hearing and reading, but
I didn't find a typo.
I just am sort of appalled at what I'm reading, I guess what I heard, that just took a while to sink in. So you're saying that there is this new industry tool where there will be a score
that will be applied to people who are slow in paying their medical bills or their ability to pay their medical bills. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey, Representative Tomei, let me start by saying this is not my area of expertise, so I've done my due diligence research, and that's when I'm going to respond to you. But I would like to follow up with making sure you have the testimony of Oregonians for Health Security and the news articles and such. My review of this is that three companies have invested in a new tool, which the some have coined MedFICO, which would track an individual's payment history for medical expenses. So exactly what you just said, and that this new tool would be available to billing departments at hospitals for them to assess a patient's medical bill paying history. The questions that remain open, because this is a tool in development, it was according to news reports, was supposed to be released last summer. I'm not clear where it is in development right now. But some of the big questions consumer advocates have are how reporting would be tracked. If I have an insurance company that's slow to pay, does that make a negative remark on my medical care score and privacy issues? As it stands right now, care is taken that you can't read my credit history and understand what kind of medical care I'm undergoing. And so consumer concerns have been raised about these types of questions. I hope that answers your question.
Well, follow up. A little bit. I guess I'm very concerned that if I go to a hospital for emergency care and they're going to be looking in their computer at my medical FICO score and it doesn't meet their qualifications, that I could either be turned away or I could get perhaps inadequate care. I mean, it seems to me that that would be the logical conclusion for this. Why else would they want this medical FICO score if it were not to limit the care that I would be receiving?
Chair Holvey, Representative Tomei, while I'm sure there are safeguards at the emergency room, other reasons why they have to provide you that type of emergency care, mm-hmm. that is precisely why we bring we back this type of bill, is because of our concern that your medical scorecard, your credit score, would limit your access to care. Now, we hear that the backers of this new tool have explained that that is not their intent. At the same time, I look and see that it was probably never the intent for an auto insurance company to be able to use my credit score to judge whether I'm a good driver or not. We've seen the slippage in how these tools are used. This is too important. We want to put a safeguard to say it won't be used in this way.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I certainly have some interest in following up on this, and I haven't, of course, had a chance to read all the other materials, but I think I might be interested in having another hearing on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think there's any business that we do. We go get a mortgage, we go buy a car, motorcycle, anything. They look at your credit rating and your ability to pay. So if I try to buy a house, that's beyond my means. We've just talked about the people who have done that, the mess that got us into. And as a result, I might be told by the banker that, no, you can't. We won't give you a loan for $250,000 house, but we'll give you one for $150,000 because you're payment record and your income says you can do that. I wonder, probably, you know, the people that walk through the door today that get free medical because they aren't covered by anything, and then that cost is borne by everybody else.
Yes.
And I went in the hospital at Coquille a while back, and I knew that if I got past 11 o'clock, my insurance would not only have to pay for another day, but I would get billed too, and even though I can afford it. I made sure I was out of there by 11. And I'm capable of paying, but I realized that that would drive up the costs for the insurance company and those types of things. So I want to hear a little bit more, but I'm very dubious of not allowing business to somehow monitor how much money we're going to put in, whether it be me and my age or someone younger. I just think that's part of the business practice that everybody uses that has a business. They're not going to let you go beyond what you can afford to pay. And the fact that it's medical is not an entitlement.
something we want to try to cover. We're dealing with this today in, what was it, 209, and all kinds of bills in the Senate now with different parts of health care to make sure people can have the best they can. But just a wide open thing where everybody can get the most of what they want, well, maybe he should have a shot of something in his knee rather than a knee replacement, because that he can afford by his credit score. I mean, it's just that type of thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. Your testimony indicates that these companies that are developing this product, theoretically at least, are Fair Isaac Tenant Healthcare Corporation and a venture capital firm. Although I'm not really into the investment world, I'm not familiar with any of those names. You also said that it would be available to hospitals. And then I'm slipping over to the Oregonians for Health Security testimony. It notes that this came out of an article in the Dallas Morning News. Do we have any evidence in the state of Oregon that any of our provider systems are seeking to buy into this technology and use it for a particular purpose?
Chair Holby, Representative Cowan, as I indicated in my testimony, I'm pleased to say I'm not bringing reports of abuses of this tool. However, I think that there is plenty of evidence that we can bring forward of how credit reporting has gone down this road in other arenas. Simply because we've not seen this brought to market, I don't have enough faith that it will not be abused as we've seen other types of credit scoring be abused. And to that end, if I may, Chair Holby, respond to comments by Representative Krieger, nothing about this would relieve a consumer's responsibility to pay. However, those concerns that we have with credit reporting point to errors and inaccuracies, which it's unfortunate if they prevent you from getting a home loan, or it's unfortunate if they prevent you from getting the car loan while you're on the car lot. It seems to me it would be an entirely different story if an error in my credit report prevented me from getting the best medical care that I actually can afford or that I actually do need. So it's the errors and inaccuracies that raise concerns and not trying to relieve consumers of their duty to pay their bills.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
I am very uncomfortable with this proposal. And I'm looking at the testimony that we have also submitted from the Hospital Association. We should not and do not override a physician's recommendation based solely on a patient's financial condition. I think that's important. And then there are other questions raised about if a consumer, a patient, if you will, requests a less expensive, this one simply talks about medications, but there is a matter of choice in this world, too, of medical care as well, about requesting, I don't think I want to pay for that procedure. What lesser procedure might you do, and it's going to be my decision making. I think this is a blanket barrier to any discussion of cost in a manner that makes me uncomfortable. I understand the theoretical problem that might exist. I think I would have to see a little evidence of any existence of it. And then I'd have to think very carefully about what we would not be precluding as well in terms of patient choice. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, and I'll try to be brief. But I'm just kind of curious, and just skimming some of the information, if maybe this is, maybe we're thinking this is something it may not be. The quick reports say that this is determination after discharge. So in some form, it looks to me like maybe it's a tool they use to determine, and again, I don't want to make the assumption, but I could see this leading to kind of a checks and balance on, do we pursue this payment or do we farm this off to somebody to pursue it Is it worth our money to pay somebody to go after these charges, or will this person pay the medical bill? What I wouldn't want it to be is a tally of how many times somebody comes to the doctor and whether or not they're allowed to come back to the doctor based on that. And I wouldn't want it to be a variation of, well, they can't afford, you know, to have that surgery now, so we'd like to farm them off somewhere else. If they need the surgery, they need surgery. But I don't necessarily know what's happening. So I tend to agree with Representative Tomei. Maybe it deserves another look. I'd like to find some more information. I completely agree, Representative Cowan. But I also am concerned that, you know, the HIPAA violations and whatnot, and some of the restrictions, I don't think would allow people to share a lot of information regarding conditions and surgeries and needed medicines, too. So I'd like to look a little further into it, if you're open to that. And, you know, maybe one more time. I don't know.
Well, Representative Widener.
Honorable Chair Holvey, I have to concur with the Honorable Chair, my other Chair, Cowan, and my other committee.
Thank you for your input. I think this bill certainly does raise a question, and I agree with Representative Cowan and Representative Tomei both. I don't know that there's an issue. I think it's something that we should keep an eye on, perhaps, that because I think hospitals at some point do have a duty to provide care to people who come to them with needs. Whether they can afford it or not, I could be wrong, but I think in some cases that's the truth. And I guess the real implication is, are hospitals going to use these credit scores and make determinations that, well, we're just not going to provide that care? That's the fundamental issue. We don't really have any evidence that says that's necessarily happening in a way that's not consistent with their duties and obligations right now, but something perhaps we should keep an eye on. But I'm not sure I'm inclined to have this hearing up again unless I'll keep it open if somebody can produce some information that will show me otherwise. But it is something of a concern we'll keep in mind. So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2959. Chair, I'd entertain a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Barton to vote on House Bill 3020.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
Chair Holvey, I would like to make a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Barton to vote on House Bill
3020. Thank you. The motion on the table is to allow suspend the rules to allow Representative Barton to vote on House Bill 3020. Any objection? Hearing a lot.
Are you all right, Representative Gunn?
Representative, I will open the work session of House Bill 3020. Representative Barton, how do you vote?
Aye.
Let the record show Representative Barton votes aye on House Bill 3020. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3020. With that, thank you very much, committee. We are not carrying any of these bills over. I do not believe. Friday we have perhaps a long and perhaps a short agenda. So with that, I will close the House Committee on Consumer Protection.